Anybody else have, yeah, Sue? Can we have a mic?
Thank you so much for sharing that story. That was really great. It reminded me how much I loved learning about family therapy. I don't practice it, but I loved it. I was learning it when I had middle-aged kids, and I was like, this makes so much sense. My question is that when you sort of gave everyone a bit of a voice and sort of let them shed their labels, like this is the good kid, this is the bad kid, and I loved the imagery of the phone, like that was just great, like finding a safe way to communicate your feelings and helping the parents think about what it might like to be that older son. Did you see the relationship between the siblings change once they weren't in those sort of roles any longer?
It was interesting because throughout the work, like the younger ones started to be less, like he was kind of acting out more, you know, he was being more...
He had more space.
Yeah.
To be that.
Yeah. I mean, he could start just being whatever he needed to, you know. They naturally did work really well together. I think, like, in the presence of a parent, especially the mom, the roles, they began to shift into these roles. So once that started to loosen, they, you were really starting, the younger one, you were like, oh, okay, you've got some, you know.
Because I think the danger of having that label in a family.
Yeah.
Is that that label sort of gets worn on your forehead. So everyone, including your siblings, interact with you as if you are that good kid or bad kid.
Right. Yeah, it's a lot to hold.
It's a lot.
Kid.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cool. Any other thoughts? Kim? Oh, we're going around the rosemary bush here.
Thanks. Just a little bit more curious about the mom. It seemed like she had a lot of, you know, projected fear and anxiety. And my worry is, not to project too much, but if she doesn't do more work herself, right, it's just gonna go back to...
Yeah, so then the couple's work was really like getting the husband to try to understand, which he really could, you know, I mean, he had a really great capacity to empathize and understand like the stress, because she was taking care of these two kids on her own a lot. And but it was really, I mean, that was part of like trying to shift the heteronormative power dynamic so that he could begin to do more in the home and take less, you know, so that she could, you know, be less burdened, but also to really understand how much emotional burden she was holding and for him to kind of support her, mm-hmm, to be there, to be her partner in that way. So that was the couple's work that we were really trying to do. And I think that, you know, I mean, it started to, but yeah, I mean, she was really, it was also kind of like her own, you know, like compulsive, sure, you know, tightening around, needing to control everything. But we had, you know, we really tried to get him to help her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other thoughts?
I was just curious, Claire. In the same way that someone just asked about if the two sons, if their dynamics started to change, like, it seems like the older son was given the opportunity to kind of like let himself come in and shine more, not just as this like labeled child. And I just wonder if the mom and him, if she started to change her view of him. Like, she kind of sounds like she didn't really think that highly of him. Like,
yeah,
did she start to change that?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, she, towards the end of it, she was really, her language started to shift. I mean, she would start coming in and be like, oh, now I'm really worried about the younger one. And we were, you know, so there was that. But then it was, she really did start to change her, the strong language softened a lot. So, you know, we had to kind of end with them, but the hope was that that would continue. But she started to actually speak positively about them, in front of them, which was important too.
Great. Thank you so much, Helen. That was amazing. And that gives us a little window. Like we were in the double, what is it? The two-way mirror or the whatever. following up, there's two cases I was thinking of sharing, so I'll have to be brief if I want to do both. But in the spirit of what you're talking about, I'll start with the couple. So this is a couple who is in their 70s, actually. Pretty unusual. that they're back in the, doing couples work. And of course, you can imagine why, because there was an affair. And it's a sort of, she comes from this very sort of patrician WASP family, and he comes from this sort of very powerful Jewish kind of high-achieving intellectual family, a very New York couple. But they were both trained to be, you know, obviously in a generation when people just didn't talk to each other, right? I mean, what are you kidding? And you know, you just keep it to yourself, and you kind of, you know, she had had a depression, a postpartum depression, in part because of that, and in part because she had a kind of probably alcoholic and abusive mother. He was a little more sort of manic-y, in part because he had a narcissistic father and a very strong mother who supported him to be a golden boy, right? So it was a very interesting dynamic. They're super, super successful people. And they raised a beautiful family, right? So they were good at the family thing. They really worked together as a team, but very traditional, heteronormative, right? I wouldn't describe it that way, but I like it. It's very technical. You know, so they worked really well as a team, but in this rigid and non-communicating cells of activity or function or responsibility, and unfortunately, as you can well imagine, the relationship just kind of slowly died over the years because there was no energy, there was no connection going back and forth. He became frustrated because she, you know, wasn't happy with how he was, you know, not intimate with her, you know, not tender, and she, you know, and he sort of withdrew from her, and she became, assumed that he just either wasn't interested or was growing out of it or whatever in this kind of, we don't talk about that kind of way, right? And of course, they didn't talk about it. They talked about this famous rug that they swept everything under the rug. It was explicit, so that was their policy. Let's just sweep it under the rug. So of course, it came back to bite them because she found out about the affair and it had been going on for a while. And what was amazing is that it kind of gave her, and she, they're both, well, she's a Buddha, a practicing Buddhist, and he's kind of, you know, enamored of anything kind of, you know, that he can talk about. So he liked the idea and had some sort of, you know, affinity, but didn't get the gist of it. And I think she's a beginning practitioner, but really had some, you know, practice and sincere interest. But what was interesting is that as a result of this finding this out, she kind of sort of broke out of her shell, you know, and it gave her, it's like the seeing that he screwed up so badly, right? And at least he had the good sense to say, I really screwed up, I'm really a jerk, and what can I do to make it up to you? I'll be here, I'll work it out with you. But of course, she was totally enraged and mistrustful and would just go off on these tirades and raging at him. And so I explained that, yes, that had to happen. And not only was it great because she was kind of really challenging, I think, for challenging him for the first time. She'd always talked about him steamrolling over her, right? And she would now had something that she could really challenge him on that I think he had enough conscience to know he should be challenged. And it became kind of this way that, you know, that the power dynamic started to shift, and it became the way that she kind of found her voice because she'd always been so, you know, kind of repressed in, you know, you just don't say it, right? And whether it's good or bad or neutral, you don't say it. And I think he responded, and again, in a very, I mean, initially, so the good things that he was doing was to try to, you know, spend less time running around the world with his fancy friends and colleagues and spend a lot more, and really sort of become devoted to her in a way, you know, spending time together, traveling together, enjoying things together in a way that he never really had been. So in a way, this was fitting into the, couples have a life cycle, and so when there's an empty nest and all the kids are off with their own children and so on and so forth, you know, the couple has to renegotiate the relationship, and they're either going to be able to reestablish some kind of intimacy or have some kind of agreement to live together in a way that works. And so this was also fitting into that, that they really kind of had to, you know, the relationship broke because it was, there was no purpose anymore. It was a family-based relationship that it was a, an arrangement, a traditional, you know, non-communicative relationship, but some affection and some, and certainly a lot of mutual respect, but no real communication. So, so in any case, I think that what then became the dynamic is that, you know, she would, he would, you know, she would be triggered by, because she was really traumatized, understandably, and would be triggered by anything that, that remotely raised this, this affair, and then he would sort of, you know, listen up to a certain point and then sort of get defensive and start kind of either mansplaining or gaslighting her and say, well, I thought we were getting over this, when are we going to get over this, right? And so there's, so that really gave me the opportunity to help start working on his, you know, complete lack of real connection to his emotionality, which was, you know, for his idea of emotionality, he is that he would talk about stories of, you know, from literature about, you know, so it's, you know, so oh yeah, well in this book, and then exactly, you know, like, you know, Middlemarch or wherever, the things I've never read, you know, so and so, this character did that. He clearly had an intuitive mind, and he his relationship, his primary relationship with his mother, so I think he was actually, there, he is a kind of a good guy and a sensitive guy, but it was all so buried under this. You have to like be, you know, like just like the waspier than the wasps, and go to Eton or else, you know, you're really worthless and useless. As that was his father's story. So he sort of really kind of armed himself from his feelings and shut them all off and became very, very effective, you know, playing in the kind of the man's world. You know, and so to kind of try to slowly try to dismantle that was the challenge, and we were able to bring some sort of, you know, some of the themes about how important connection is to people and how really what we're talking about here is not just something that happened, but a kind of something that exposed the fault line in their ability to connect and hence made them both feel traumatized and became a kind of explosive and brought out the worst in both of them. And I think as a result of sort of slowly trying to connect that, the pattern of traumatizing back to their families of origin, you know, in terms of, you know, her feeling he became the mother who rejected him because the sister was always better. There's another one of those, same story. The sister was always better than she was. And she became the father who, you know, who was, you know, just demeaning and humiliating him, and he was supposed to just take it or you know, fight back. So they both had their, were triggering each other's traumas, and I think the main, the turning points really came when I think, you know, I think I tried to sort of hold both their hands, because could you imagine doing this kind of work at the age of 75 or 77? I mean, really, like, that's, it takes a lot of courage. And I think they did really have a deep kind of mutual empathy, because they were both survivors of these kind of emotionally deprived families, and both actually also interestingly people who had a primary relationship with the opposite sex parents. So they kind of had a parental relationship with the other person as the good object, but it wouldn't warrant any real adult intimacy. It wasn't strong enough to hold that, and they couldn't risk shattering it by really talking about what was happening. So, you know, so I think that what turned the corner in terms of, at a certain point that, you know, after really pushing them both, because he became more and more afraid, the more I kept saying, no, you really have to not, don't explain to her what she's doing wrong or could do better. Tell her how you're feeling, so that she understands you're human, do you know what I mean? So that she knows who you are again, so she can get to know her husband. And likewise with her, you know, it doesn't when you challenge him, it doesn't just have to be about the affair. It can be about how he just isn't listening to you or takes you for granted or talks over you or whatever it is. And so trying to get them both to kind of venture into the place where they had the courage and confidence to risk really being vulnerable with each other. And you know, I think her practice was extremely helpful. And they were lines from the mind training, because I love, as you'll see when I talk about couples work with the mind training, I always like to throw in some lines from the Mind Training almost with every couple. You know, drive all blame into one is certainly a big biggie. But in this case, always rely on the happy mind, because they were actually starting to develop a kind of romance for the first time in their life, really. They never really had a romantic relationship on some level. They kind of went through the motions as very young kids and starting with families and so on. And so they were really starting to have these wonderful moments together, and then something would trigger her and she would, you know, bite his head off, and he would get defensive and or withdraw in shame and defeat and fear. So I think it was really critical that she started upping her practice, and I gave her the Mind Training to read and started looking on, you know, how can I really see, accept what is good and lean into what is good, and just try to give myself a chance to feel who he is and what it's really like between us, rather than staying back in the narrative, which is, you know, he's really my mother who really, whatever is said and done, he really doesn't love me better. He really loves the other one better. So as her practice, she was really able to kind of let the explosive stuff pass more quickly, or moderate it with some kind of, you know, humor and really gradually keep bringing her back herself. She used Headspace a lot, which I haven't used, so that's, I don't know, we could prescribe that for our clients, but especially, you know, working with the idea of how this traumatic reactivity really was making her, you know, closing the door that she wanted to be open and kind of really wearing her down more than anybody and re-injuring herself. So I think that you know, it was really kind of touch and go there, because between her, you know, totally understandable PTSD that got triggered by his kind of totally stonewalling her and living this double life for a number of years, and then his kind of shame-based, well, you know, and you know, the guys' club thing, you know, of you know, well, the Europeans are okay with this kind of thing, and, you know, all of this, but also really trying to, you know, act like he was trying to protect her, and he assumed she really didn't want to be intimate. So his defensiveness and the shame, you know, the disavowal of his shutdown and the shame that drove this kind of acting out on his part, I didn't think that either one of them could break through that stuff. But I think remarkably, they seem to be doing it. I'm not finished with them by any means. They're not finished with me, I don't think. but at least they don't seem to be finished with each other. And it does seem like they're really, I think, he really began to get that he had to share with her emotionally, so that if he was feeling humiliated, he had to say, I feel like such a jerk. I feel like I failed you so badly, instead of, you really should get over this. And she realized that when she was feeling mistrustful of him, she needed to find a way to say, I don't know, sometimes it's hard for me to know whether I can still trust you, rather than, you know, you enjoyed being with that woman more than me, or whatever. I do think the pivotal thing for her was her ability to draw on her practice to really recognize the balance between, you know, because in a way this explosion liberated her feelings and was a great, you know, boon to her, right? Because she was really able to kind of break out of the spell of her childhood, but then it was so uncontrollable because there was no, she didn't have any training for how to modulate all this stuff, so it was just coming out like fire-breathing, you know, dragon stuff. So she, using her interest in the Dharma, she was actually able to start to practically get some ability to modulate or just repair after she exploded, to come back to him and say, you know, well, what's really going on, or here's what I was really upset about. And so, you know, it seems like they're going to pull it out. They're going to be they're going to have another couple of decades of very happy marriage together, or the only really decades of happy marriage apart from their kids. So, yeah. Any thoughts about that as a story? Yeah.
I'm just curious about did the husband begin to read or practice or take in any of the Buddhist studies? It sounded like you said he was sort of interested in it, but like it sounded almost like he was sort of intellectually curious about it, but hadn't actually done any investigation himself. And my second question is just more out of curiosity. Was this an affair that had happened years before that had begun and ended, and then she found out about it years later, or was this something that ended when she found out about it?
Okay. So again, like a lot of people, he was sort of interested in Buddhism as a kind of dilettante, and it was sort of more like her thing. She had some very close friends who were very, very serious, and you know, sort of as part of her path, she'd gone to Nepal or I think Bhutan. She went on some trips with Bhutan, but he was interested insofar as it was a curiosity. But this therapy was really the first chance where he had to sort of have a real experiential challenge, test, or taste of what we're talking about in terms of working, really building real compassion. Because he's somebody who was very good at poetry, as you can maybe imagine, would sort of talk to her about, would bring roses and bottles of champagne by the whatever, take her to Paris. But and really be very poetic about how much he loved her, which I think it was in a way sincere, but in a way it was also just completely cut off from the complexity of who he was as a real person, his woundedness. So I think it was really more challenging him to have the trust that the two of them could go into who they really were, and there was wounded parts of them, and not to mention like through the pathway of this terrible breach of faith or harm that he did. So he really was very afraid of that. And so it was really sort of, helping him understand this was the reality of what people were talking about in terms of, looking at the mind, transforming the mind, that there was potential through, awareness and effort. But it was mostly in a discursive way. I mean, he's very interested in some, some lamas. He has some sort of, some of these sort of sentimental attachments to lamas that people have, and art, Buddhist art and things like that. But it was not real, and so this is as real as it got. This was an ongoing thing, which she found out about pretty much. I mean, the story is as it was ending, which I think is true because of certain facts which are not relevant. But nonetheless, it had gone on for a number of years, and so the breach was really, really in a way a miracle that they got through this. It's a miracle, and I think it's also a testament to the sense of deep underlying empathy, because I do think they both have deep empathy and affection for each other, even though they wouldn't know how to express it. And I mean, I think they're more able to do that now. But also, raising a really healthy family, of kids who are at least able to try to figure things out for themselves, and having, that as a kind of love container, as a kind of healthier basis on which to kind of now themselves start to heal as people from their wacky families. Yeah, Claire.
It's
sort of like it's like the Buddhist grapevine, so it's sort of I was working with somebody that was a dear friend of hers, and so it's more, that's how, I mean, most of the time in private practice that's how people come through. It's like social media before the social media.
but like when they came to you, were you like, hey, you should try this thing, or were they like, we came because we think this could work really well for us, teach us about
psychotherapy. No, I think that they were really coming, she came first and more from that point of view of, I really need help, I mean, as a person. So some of it was, and because she had a mental health history in the past, some of it was just kind of medical, that she wanted somebody to help her through this trauma. And then I think the fact that on top of that, there was a shared value system, or that I could maybe help her use her interest in Buddhism to help heal, was extra appealing to her and maybe added a degree of trust. And I think actually that, you know, a lama who, they knew had renewed their vows a number of years earlier. And I think that was kind of an important gesture, and there was some way in which that promised a kind of new phase for their relationship. So there was a way in which it also wove into, his life or their life as a couple, too.
A question.
Yeah.
How do you, when you're in the room and people are getting, especially with a couple, and they're getting reactive, like, how are you in the room with them? And I'm just thinking about, like, because when we're at, when we work with couples, we're always, there's this thing called the vulnerability cycle. So there's you try to identify an underlying vulnerability, and then there's a survival strategies that somebody enacts to protect the vulnerability, and then the survival strategies then kind of trigger the other person's vulnerability. They have their own survival strategies and trigger the other one, you know, so it's kind of like, I'm curious, like, how do you, especially in work using the mind training and like, your presence in the room, if they're getting reactive, even if it's a reactivity that's going inward or however that's showing up, like, what do you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the language I use is very, very similar. I talk about the wounded child and the survivor child. Okay. So, and then how the partner uses their survivor child, who gets triggered by the threats to the wound, to interface or to protect themselves, and how that creates a kind of misalignment or traumatic reenactment or whatever. And what I do is, generally I sort of, you have to let it happen because you have to have something to work with.
Right.
But I'm not into watching people fight. I mean, I don't see that particularly productive. So I'll say, okay, now push the pause button. And generally then I'll go into what each of them was feeling at that moment. So try to get them in the safety of having a referee who's conducting things, to try to be able to do the internal discovering of their woundedness, and then maybe some to have some perspective on their survivor.
Right.
I'll often use this kind of empathy, I forgot exactly the technical term used, mentalizing practice, to sort of, what do you think he was thinking, she was thinking? How do you feel when she says that, he says that? If there's an exposure to vulnerability, you always want to see, does the other person get it?
Yeah.
And you always want to sort of bring language to that and say, did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Can you feel that? Mm-hmm. How did it feel when she said so-and-so or when he said such-and-such?
Right.
So there's a lot of this, it's similar, the dance is similar to kind of trying to rewire in a way or reopen the channels of healthy communication, and slowly pare away all of the accretion of defenses that have it stuck in this rut or this mode of mutual trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Kim.
I find myself thinking about, like, wow, did they still stay together? Because, at that age. So I was like, was there in sessions that they were still wondering, like, oh, are we moving forward or are we splitting? Like, or is it just like the mystery of love? Or what do you, like, what's the glue? Like, or is it just like, no, we still see that there's, we have stuff to work out together.
Yeah.
And
Well, of course, it was more of an issue for her, like that she, I think, he's very much a family man, so he didn't know why he wanted to lose his family.
Okay.
But she was so deeply wounded, there were times when she felt, how can I be with this man? How can I trust him? How can I ever trust him again? That was for like months and months and months and months and months, understandably. And so I would try to help her you know, sort of empower that skepticism and get her to test and challenge him more, like saying, you really don't know this man. Like, and he's not able to show himself to you, so you have to challenge him. So I think, but neither one of them really particularly wanted to get a divorce. I mean, mostly they have a lot of friends who've been divorced who are now living kind of, you know, lonely, you know, empty lives. And they have a very happy, lively family that they want to be able to enjoy together. So there were a lot of things, as well as I think this, some of these deeper empathy things, that I do think that they recognize each other's woundedness on some level, and they caretake each other on some level, but not in an intimate way, not in a way where it's overt. So, you know, and honestly, I think, you know, the thing that was the biggest obstacle was not, I can't live with you, clearly they both have been worried until really quite recently that they would never get over it, you know, and that the hurt and the anger and the poison would never really be metabolized. And of course, I tried to assure them that was possible, but you can't, I mean, I couldn't tell them it was inevitable because it depends on work. That isn't just going to happen just because of tincture of time, no way. So then the real question was, do they both have enough confidence that they could actually work with this stuff and try to do their part? And then, of course, he was doing the typical sort of gaslighting thing of saying, well, but she's the one who's really hurt here, and it's really her issues, and she needs to talk to you, Doc. And I would say to him, oh, no, wait a minute there. So, you know, yeah, any other thoughts or questions? Should I share this one of the story? Yes, Melissa.
I just have a question about how are you able to take care of yourself within these more difficult sessions? Like, I mean, you're definitely a professional, I've been doing this for how many years, but I imagine there's times where your own opinions and your own judgments may come up, like, oh, well, you weren't such a family man when you, whatever. But how in those moments do you take yourself out of the situation and take care of yourself? I guess a question for both of you.
Well, that's what, where the mind training comes in for me. Because, like, you know, it isn't, people talk about how you have to be, you know, have unconditional acceptance or unconditional love for your clients, but then when it comes to practice, we're pretty good at picking and choosing favorites and good guys and bad guys and liking some people. And in a couples therapy, that's death. You just, and family too, you can't like some people better than other people. You can be aware that you like some people better than other people, but you can't let it be.
Yeah.
And you've got to really use your practice to realize that everybody's got their story, everybody's got their wound, and everybody's got their side in whatever happened. And that's kind of one of the themes that came up. Do you want to share?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think in any kind of therapy, but definitely, you know, if you're doing family or couples, I mean, you really have to be always, I mean, for us, it's like the language is like, always stay curious, right? And if you're not being, if your stuff is getting in the way of, like, you know, because you just can't get over, you know, it's stopping the curiosity. You have to find a way, and that's kind of, you work with that. If there's something that, because there will, especially when you do family work, there's like, people get really triggered because they're like, oh, that's like my dad, I can't be in the room with it, you know? And you gotta like really work with, you know, because you're their therapist. So then you go to supervision, you go to your mentors, you go to your support group to be like, these are, and you try to work through these feelings. And so that you can get to a place where you're no longer, you know, your own sort of counter-transference is getting in the way. You can just be in the room and have empathy for this person and realize, like, yeah, like all of, you know, it's just like when we do all these practices for the challenging person, you know, to try to get back to a place where you can have sort of, you know, unconditional compassion and empathy for this person, knowing that, like, I don't know the whole story, so I'm here to find out. And, but it's like, that is, you know, it's like, if you can no longer be curious, you gotta, like, you need to get help. You know, it's like, so we have a responsibility to kind of know if that's happening and to kind of take care of ourselves.
So if we're okay with that, I'll just briefly, okay.
Actually, I to challenge him.
Sorry,
here. Can you say what you mean by that and how?
Well, in other words, like, she would challenge him by bringing up all the dirty details of this affair that she got out of him. She sort of did the Inquisition, and she got every single little detail out of him. And so she was able to use it all against him, like when they walked past a restaurant, oh, you went there with her and had croissant or whatever, you know? and then I would try to help her sort of get back in the moment. And I'd say, like, first of all, what was really, why is that woman still in your life? What purpose is she serving for you? You know, what's really underneath your being so triggered? Is it just about what happened, or is there also something, you know, some way in which it's hard for you to believe that things can be good or are really good when they seem to be good or they feel good? And then in those moments, can you share what's actually happening for you in the moment? Right. So it's same work with her, is instead of really using her very high level of cognition and, she had a lot of chutzpah actually when it push came to shove, to really make herself vulnerable and to say, you know, I'm feeling triggered by this. I really feel like you really loved her better or whatever. You really don't love me. It's hard for me to feel that you really do love me. And so that he could then respond to where she was really at instead of this legalistic, something he was trapped by, you know.
Yeah. Were the adult children aware?
The adult children were aware, yeah.
Were they aware of that their parents were in therapy as well?
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't gotten the reviews yet in terms of their opinion about how it all worked. I guess at some point we'll see that. So let me just briefly share this other story that I think is interesting because it goes back to one of the issues that Helen raised about the illusory personhood. Because I was just meeting with this woman today. So she's one of the people that I've worked with who is a cancer survivor. And she has been in the got to know me through these meditation groups where she learned a lot of meditation skills. And of course, as you know, being sort of, you know, the Tibetan Wala that I am, that the meditation skills, it starts with a fair amount of mindfulness, but then we pretty soon get into compassion work and working with emotions. And so she had some of a grounding in that and decided to come to work on her own issues. This is the daughter of two alcoholics. Actually, you have to probably say three because they got divorced and then the mother married another alcoholic that was even worse. Really an incredibly bright woman, incredibly resourceful, ended up sort of caretaking the mother. Eventually she got the mother into recovery and herself got into recovery and in through college met a mentor who was an acting coach. And that man became a kind of idealized partner, father figure. There was a time when there was a little romance between them, but basically it ended up being kind of like a family romance, really. He loved her and he had been divorced, or maybe his wife died, I can't remember. But he really kind of was a very nurturing man who really kind of was drawn to her and her intelligence and her vulnerability and was very good to her and supported her, and she, of course, was very good to him, too. And so he died recently. So part of what we were doing now is her kind of being re-traumatized by that loss because it was probably the closest thing to a family or a parent that she ever had. And so what she talks about is how she kind of keeps punishing herself and going back to this place of, I must have done something wrong. And, you know, I made the wrong decision or I, you know, whatever. So we've been working on trying to go under that narrative to whatever feeling of, or deeper, you know, sort of family scripted drama we're talking about, her sense of identity, and we got to the place of her really blaming her, because her mother could be very abusive. And, you know, she was telling me today about how her mother, you know, when I threw all her clothes on the floor and wrote a big, you know, note on the door saying, get out of this house immediately. she'd taken on some of that self-attack, as kids do, and used that to kind of adapt to the mother's rage and then, unfortunately, never really got over it. And so whenever things were distressing, she'd go on a self-attacking, you know, kind of rant or into a vortex of it. And so I tried to help her see that at the bottom of it was this girl who was just trying to adapt to her mom, right? And yet also maybe holding on to some desperate hope that maybe in fact she was the one who was wrong, and maybe somebody, there was some kind of reasonably functional person who would come to arrive and take care of her. So she kind of had this tendency to slip into this victim narrative. So we were just talking today about how, and she was finally able to sort of start to see how that victim narrative or the traumatized sense of self or whatever, it was a very real sense, but it didn't represent the other part of her, because she knows she's a very super capable, super competent person, and she knows that the man who became her mentor saw that in her and saw her capacity and loved it, but she was not able to own it or feel it like it was her. So we were into this whole thing about, well, because when she lets go of feeling like she must have done something wrong, or there must be something wrong with her, she starts to feel very disoriented and kind of lost. It's kind of her anchor. So how can I be a person? So I was talking exactly about this because she's an actress. She's an actress. She's an acting coach. I said, well, just think about an actor. You know, people go and you're trying all these different personalities and you're not any of them, but, you know, you're still able to be in them for a while and actually end up, you know, maybe even being more, whatever, expressive. Mm-hmm. So supposing you just thought about that as one. Now, normal people just get into a character and then they get stuck in it, like concrete. They don't even know they're acting, but they are acting. And so what if you were sort of think about that really your real self is the part of you who's an actor, and this is just what your original role that you can't quite get unstuck from, but that you actually have this free capacity to sort of adapt skillfully in different situations. So I wanted to share that because it really kind of worked for her, because that's, it's, you know, it's partly the, spoke to her experience, but also using the language of her, you know, her adult life. So, yeah, it was very far out.
That's great.
Yeah.
That was really amazing. Just thinking of like our first role. You know, that we played,
right.
You know, as like we were just illusory beings, you know, and just trying to survive or just, you know, make do or adapt to these other personalities, you know, traumatic or even just what seemed traumatic because we were just so young and vulnerable. But that's just such a beautiful way of like looking at our lives that we played, we just played a role. And we got comfortable in it, and then we just kept playing it because we weren't trained as professional actors to play any other role. And so we just found the same play. Yeah. We just kept creating the same fucking play instead of like changing our role.
Yeah, but the thing, the bridge that made that possible was that she'd done enough. I mean, she'd done a couple of iterations of the program in that I do at New York Hospital. Enough so that she was able to understand things like negativity bias and traumatized sense of self, so that she was able to actually see that sense of herself as, you know, this guilty party, or this person who always does things wrong, as a, you know, as just an experience that she'd over-identified with, and is not based in kind of not the only part of her. Think about how much more. And you know, that's something else I was talking to her about. Is you think about it as an actor, how many roles you can play, and that's true of every one of us. Like, how much flexibility or potential do we have that we're just not using? And so it's not just the acting that made that possible. It's the fact that she was able to step away from her traumatized sense of self, which I think is largely because of the work that she did in our meditation groups. So, okay. So we're almost out of time. Anybody else have any thoughts you want to share about that? We have a break.
This is our last class of this module, and now we have a break. So I hope you all enjoy the time off. We will reconvene January 4th, right? It's a Friday.
That's a Friday. Friday to, yeah.
So that's for the intercession retreat. That'll be in the evening, right? So the Friday evening.
I think we start at 7.
Friday evening.
No, I'm sorry, 6. You're right, 6. Yeah.
Yeah, so six. We'll send all the details out. But it'll be like the Friday evening and then all day Saturday and then like a half day Sunday. And that will, do you want to share? What
as my Italian grandfather used to say, between 6 o'clock. I'll meet you between the 6 o'clock.
Right. Early afternoon. Yeah.
And Helen's going to share with you a kind of prompt and experiential kind of reflection that hopefully you'll be able to chew on over the course of the intercession and help to change gears or prepare your mind for the next phase, which is really clinical application. Before we go into the mentor bonding or the embodied practices, we're going to really try to look at application of the compassion practices.